I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Chances are you pay a higher federal income tax rate than the 25 richest Americans. Billionaires like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, George Soros, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates. ProPublica, the nonprofit investigative journalism organization, received 15 years of IRS data on these uber-wealthy Americans from an anonymous source. They published their findings this week, the secret IRS files, writing, quote, "It demolishes the cornerstone myth of the American tax system that everyone pays their fair share and the richest Americans pay the most." According to the story, some years these wealthy people paid very little in federal income taxes, and some years they paid none, using legal loopholes and donations, write-offs, and a system that favors wealth over labor, investors over wage earners, and borrowers over those who live within their means. One of the authors of this explosive news story is our guest, Jesse Eisinger, joining us by Skype. He's senior reporter and editor at ProPublica. Jesse, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Marty. And I heard the pledge drive earlier that, you know, and I love WHYY and I love Debbie Builder, my high school classmate and producer. So I'm always happy to come on your show.
Well, I do appreciate that. We all love Debbie Builder. So it's great that she can bring us all together once again. Let me ask you a little bit about how you got this information. I know there's much that you cannot reveal, but even more importantly, how getting information from an anonymous source, I'm assuming at the IRS, how you know it's accurate and complete? How are you able to vet it?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We have sources all the time give us information. Sometimes they give it anonymously, and we don't know who they are. And what we do with information is put it through a very careful prism of trying to figure out, first and foremost, the most important thing, is it accurate? Is it verifiable? Can we verify it? And then the second thing is it newsworthy? Mm-hmm. And so we did receive this vast trove of information that covers thousands of the wealthiest Americans. This is not Joe the plumber's tax returns. This is the 1% of the 1% covering more than 15 years. And we've been culling it, going through it very, very carefully. First step was verifying it. And the second question we asked was, is it newsworthy? And what is newsworthy about it? And we decided we have a series of stories we're going to do. The first story was about 25 of the wealthiest Americans, and we only named a small number of names. We're being very careful and responsible stewards of this information. And what we say in the story, the findings of the story are, one, that some of these mega billionaires can pay zero in federal income tax and have in recent years. And the second thing is that overall, looking at them overall with a new kind of analysis, they pay very little tax compared to their overall wealth. And we thought both of those findings were clearly in the public interest.
And I want to get to all of that and even some more issues that are raised by this explosive article. Publishing taxpayer information, is that criminal? Taxpayer information is supposedly confidential. Is someone in hot water?
Maybe. I don't want to comment on that about, you know, the source or sources, but publishing information that is in the public interest, we believe, is protected by the First Amendment. And so that's the bar that we think is important. In fact, journalists private information all the time, information that is confidential, sometimes that has been illegally obtained, information certainly that people don't want out. And sometimes we do have to outweigh the privacy concerns. Some are legitimate privacy concerns, some are excessive privacy concerns, by judging something in the public interest. But we don't do it willy-nilly. We don't do it irresponsibly. We do it at ProPublica with great care. So it wasn't just me making this decision and publishing everything. Paul Keel and Jeff Ernsthausen, my brilliant colleagues, were going through this and making that judgment. And then we have a whole host of editors and lawyers all trying to make decisions that only are focused on the public interest.
We're talking about, you do name some names, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Michael Bloomberg, Carl Icahn, George Soros, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg. Are we talking about all men?
No, there are some women in the top 25. There are some Walton heirs. There are some heirs to the Mars candy fortune. In this case, the names that we focused on were all men. The deca-billionaires and centa-billionaires in the country are disproportionately men, although there's, you know, there are a few, like Mackenzie Scott, we mentioned, because she filed jointly with Jeff Bezos. She was married to Jeff Bezos and now has been divorced. Laureen Powell Jobs is, of course, one of the most powerful billionaires in the country. But the vast majority are men. They're white men.
You took their income, and you know, income is a. I thought I knew what income was until I read your piece, and we will get to that. But what you found, adding all the assets, the wealth that these people had, if they got a paycheck, they would be paying something like 37%. That would be the highest rate for the kind of money that comes in. But their true tax rate was 3.4%. That gets us to this whole discussion about what we tax in this country, whether it's
right.
labor, you know, if you get a paycheck, a W-2, or whether you have wealth and stocks and property. Help us tease that all apart.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. That's the perfect distillation of it. And it's not a complex idea, but it is complex in its details. But you and I and most of the listeners are in the tax system. And what I mean by that is we work to live. We need to work to live, and we get a salary, and taxes are extracted out of our salary, federal taxes for quote unquote income tax. And then there's something called, the jargon is payroll tax, right, which goes supposedly earmarked for Social Security and Medicare, but not really. It just goes into a big pot. Those are the big federal taxes. Now, the ultra wealthy are completely outside of the system. The reason they're outside of the system is that their wages and salaries are essentially non-existent or voluntary. Jeff Bezos gets a middle-class salary of about $80,000 a year. Sometimes these guys ostentatiously take $1 in salary. Mark Zuckerberg, the Google boys, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. And that seems like a kind of self-sacrifice and kind of solidarity with their employees. But in fact, salaries are taxed, as you said, at the highest marginal rate. So every dollar over a certain amount, $628,000 or so for a couple this year, gets taxed at 37%. So it's not such a self-sacrifice. Instead, what they do is they have wealth. They have unrealized gains in their stocks or assets. You know, Michael Bloomberg has not publicly traded stock. He's got a private company. The Kochs have a private company. And that appreciates. And then some of these billionaires, if they don't sell, they prefer not to sell. So they have other strategies to realize profits from their wealth without selling, without paying taxes. And we can get into that in a second. But that is the key element. They are outside the tax system. And then so what we did was we compared how much taxes they pay compared to this explosion in wealth. And the top 25 pay $3.40 for every $100 that their wealth goes up, 3.4%. Now, you and I and the typical American is paying about, you know, making about $60,000 or $70,000 in salary. They pay 14% of income tax. So the equivalent comparison, the proper comparison, it's a little bit of an apples and oranges comparison because we're comparing to wealth growth, but we believe that wealth growth is really the meaningful way to measure their true income, and the true tax rate is $3.40 versus $14 for the dollars on $100 of income for the typical American.
Jesse, let me quote from the story. If you own a company and take a huge salary, you'll pay 37% in income tax on the bulk of it. Sell stock and you'll pay 20% on capital gains tax and lose some control over your company. But take out a loan and these days you'll pay a single-digit interest rate and no tax. Since the loan must be paid back, the IRS doesn't consider them income. Banks typically require collateral, but the wealthy have plenty of that. So that, you know, how they can afford all their houses and all their stuff is through loans.
Exactly. Exactly.
I was shocked read that.
I mean, what's funny is this is all well understood by tax experts and certainly well understood by the ultra wealthy. And so, you know, there have been some people who are very jaded and shrug and say, all we've done is describe the tax system. And to which we say, yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. All we have done is describe the tax system as we have it today and with specific numbers and names, which no one has ever seen before. And we think that that's quite illuminating. And the question is, does this system have to be? It turns out that not taxing unrealized gains was not brought down from Mount Sinai in the tablets. It's not a fixed natural law. This was not something from the Hammurabi Code or from Athens. This is a policy choice, a relatively recent policy choice. And what we wanted to have people understand is the consequences of that choice.
Well, and what it says is that our tax system, in a sense, favors wealth over labor.
Yes, exactly. It favors wealth over labor in myriad ways. The most basic way is that wealth, when you realize those gains, it has a favorable tax treatment. When you sell a stock, you get a capital gain. If it's a long-term capital gain, it's 20% versus the 37% for the highest marginal rate of income. But the key factor that you highlighted in the previous question was, so how do they live? And what if they're not selling anything, how do they live? Right. And the answer is that they're borrowing. Not everybody has all these strategies. We have no evidence, for instance, that Warren Buffett, who takes a very low income, borrows. He may not. We don't see any evidence of that in the tax returns. And some of them sell and some of them have high income. There's a whole variety of techniques and strategies and business models. But many of them do, like Elon Musk borrows, and it comes out in court filings and it comes out in securities filings. It came out a few years ago that Larry Ellison had a $10 billion credit line. Mm-hmm. Larry Ellison was able to buy a Hawaiian island with his wealth. He literally has one of the Hawaiian islands. So this is one of the ways that they fund their lifestyles and fund their businesses without being taxed ever.
Well, you know what, Jesse, we have to take a very short break. And I should add that what we're talking about is legal. And that's Jesse Eisinger. He's senior reporter and editor at ProPublica, one of the authors of their recent report just out this week. The secret IRS files, trove of never before seen records, reveal how the wealthiest avoid income tax. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jesse Eisinger from ProPublica, talking about their new expose just out this week, how the wealthiest Americans are able to legally pay little or no federal income taxes. And again, you can join us, Radio Times, at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Here's some comments that went up right as we started the show from Stu. There's nothing new about these revelations. It's all legal because the rich and corporations buy politicians. A comment from Reggie. Every time a politician goes on TV, they should hold up their tax returns and tell the public, this is why you should vote for me. We need more transparency. Any comment, Jesse, to either of our listeners there, Stu or Reggie?
Well, I think it's very cynical and jaded that people think that there's nothing new or that they knew this already. And I actually don't believe it. I defy anyone to have said, to admit or think that they would have said last week that if I had asked them, do you think that Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Michael Bloomberg, whose company, private company, is throwing off billions and billions of dollars, are these people paying zero in federal income taxes in recent years? Jeff Bezos did it in 2007 and 2011. Elon Musk did it in 2018. Bloomberg did it in 2010. Did they pay zero in taxes? Almost no one would have said it. So, you know, there is a well-known phenomenon that real estate moguls, like the former president of the United States, you may recall him, that they pay zero because real estate, commercial real estate, is very tax advantaged. But very few people, if any, would have predicted that for giant tech mogul billionaires whose businesses are throwing off that kind of profit. So it's a very cynical response, and I understand it, to think like, oh, the rich can get away with anything, and we know this. But in fact, we just don't know. We didn't know this. The other thing, well, if you want to ask another question.
Well, yeah, what crosses my mind, and maybe the fact that people are not so shocked, and I don't want to speak for all people when I say this, is that we know that there are very profitable companies who pay almost no taxes in this country as well. So it seems part of the same pattern here.
Yes, there is a similar pattern. There, you know, really different things in the specifics. Yes, we have had a golden age of corporate tax avoidance, too. And often these same companies like Google, Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, those are all major tax avoiders. And then even some of the old industrial companies. I mean, GE is kind of the pioneer of corporate tax avoidance, and the corporate tax rate has fallen and corporate tax havens have risen in the last few decades, which has allowed that. So I do understand there's some conflating with zero taxes from corporations and thinking cynically that wealthy people can get away with everything and anything. I wrote an entire book about how wealthy people don't go to prison. So sure. I'm sort of familiar with this idea of elite impunity. But I think that the specifics here, I would hope that people really kind of look at and focus on and try to understand how this works actually with specifics in the real world.
Does anyone who we would consider wealthy actually pay that rate? Was it 37%, 39%? Does anyone pay that?
We did find some folks like that, and we may do some stories along those lines too. You know, I'm kind of curious why they do, and whether that's kind of a choice or whether they kind of are locked in the system. There are the working wealthy, and those people get salaries, and then they get money that's taken out of them. So celebrities, those kinds of people, they're the working wealthy and the working rich, and so they pay higher taxes. We are going to have stories throughout the year on this, careful, responsible, modest stories. We're not just publishing this willy-nilly, as I said before. And some of that will possibly highlight some of that question and people who pay high taxes.
Here's an email from Sherry. The marginal rate goes up steeply for families with two working parents, making it difficult to accumulate wealth or get ahead for the middle class. Something we'll be talking with our second guest about. But I'd just be curious, Jesse. I mean, wealth is a kind of a safety net for people. And often it's that home is the main source that people have. But people have 401ks and things like that. So there is investment in the stock market, for instance.
Yeah, although the vast majority of Americans don't have any stock market investments or have very little compared to their overall picture. Huge portions of the population have negative net worth, meaning that they have more debts than assets. And the people who do have net worth, the vast majority of their wealth is tied up in their home. Right. And this brings me to an excellent point that a lot of people have made, and we sort of only glancingly make it in the piece. But in addition to the fact that it's difficult to build wealth over time, that's certainly true. The average typical person pays a wealth tax. Now, we've heard a lot about wealth taxes for billionaires from proposals like the one that Elizabeth Warren offered in the primary and the one that Bernie Sanders often has offered. And people say wealth taxes are impossible. They can't be enforced, and you can't value the assets. But it turns out that average people do actually pay a version of the wealth tax. It's called property tax. Every homeowner pays a local property tax in the country, and the hard to value illiquid assets of the homes are valued and taxed, and people have to pay that whether they sell or not. So there is a wealth tax regime in the country. It just doesn't touch the truly ultra wealthy.
Do you see this article, and as you say, there will be others, as an argument for what Bernie Sanders said or Elizabeth Warren has said about a wealth tax? Elizabeth Warren says a 2% tax on net worth over $50 million. Is this an argument for that, seeing that these very wealthy people are paying so little in federal income tax?
Well, we're just journalists. We are not advocates, and we're not policy wonks. We certainly didn't make an argument explicitly for any policy prescription. Whether people look at this system and make a decision about whether this is the right system and how to fix the system, our charter is about having an impact and seeing something that is wrong and questionable and hoping that we bring about some kind of beneficial change to that. I am really not certain in my own mind what I would support if I really had to try to think about it. There are a variety of proposals. It's certainly true that a wealth tax has a lot of hurdles, and some countries have abandoned them in recent years, and relatively few countries have them. Switzerland has one that works pretty well, but oddly enough, they don't have capital gains tax, and it's a relatively modest tax. So it's not true that wealth tax doesn't work anywhere, but they are challenging. If the United States were to lead the world in introducing something like that or taxing unrealized gains, I think a lot of the world would follow and it would be much harder to evade.
Interesting. That's Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter, editor at ProPublica, one of the authors of their new report out this week. It's titled The Secret IRS Files: Trove of Never-Before-Seen Records Reveal How the Wealthiest Avoid Income Tax. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Jesse, there's a lot of talk about raising the federal income tax rate up to, closer to 40%. There's some pushback. This was as a result of the Trump tax reduction of just a couple of years ago. But if this were to go up to 39%, would this touch any of these ultra rich people and how they make their money?
Hardly at all. It would make almost no difference on the ultra wealthy, the top 0.1 of 0.1%. So that was one of the major points of the story, is that is a modest incremental change that wouldn't touch the ultra wealthy. The Biden proposals, another point that we made in the story is that the discussion in Washington has been dominated about rates on capital gains, rates on income, and those are essentially beside the point, or they're far, far less important than what we tax. And so we should really kind of think about that when we're putting forward these proposals. There are some Biden proposals that are ambitious. There's, although it's really not clear whether they would affect wealth accumulation in people's lifetimes, but there is this giant flaw widely recognized across the political spectrum as a flaw in the code. It's got a very arcane name, which I will mention in a second. But what happens in that is that if you've got a stock that you bought at $10 and it goes up to $110, if you sold it today, you would have $100 of capital gain because you bought it at 10 and you sold it at 110, and you'd have to pay 20% on that. If you died tomorrow and gave it to your kids, that steps up. It goes all the way up to 110, and then no one ever pays capital gains on that. The kids don't pay capital gains on that. The capital gains disappears for the purposes of taxes. It's called the step up in basis, an arcane little flaw in the code. And the Biden administration has proposed getting rid of that, and that would make a big, big difference to how these ultra-wealthy people shelter their fortunes and are able to pass it on to their children, to their estates. And so if they were to get rid of that, it would be significant. But the proposals have already run into headwinds in Congress. And so whether they can get any of this passed remains to be seen.
Here's a comment from Craig. He says the tax system favors the largest companies and individuals who can hire armies of accountants and lawyers to navigate the tax code. Those of us that own small to mid businesses do pay the marginal and corporate rates. Amazon and others are at a competitive advantage due to tax avoidance. I mean, and yes, there are these armies of tax people to lawyers and such to look through our tax code to find all these loopholes and write-offs.
There's absolutely no question that that's true. What we were trying to get at is sort of the matrix, like looking at the system as a whole, this entire legal construct that's routine and well understood, that doesn't require sophisticated lawyers, right? Because all it requires you to do is sell and borrow against your assets. And then it does require some sophistication to avoid gift and estate tax at death. And that does require this stuff. But it's an absolutely correct point. And what has happened is, and this was the previous set of stories that Paul Keel and I did a few years ago, is that the IRS has been gutted. So tax enforcement has been gutted. We are at record lows for, we haven't had as few auditors at the IRS since the 1950s, when Stalin was in power. Wow. In the Soviet Union, and Eisenhower was president, and we have fewer IRS agents today than then, and the country is, you know, twice the size, and the economy was a seventh of the size or something like that, and audits of the wealthy, audits of corporations have collapsed, so there's very, very little civil enforcement and almost no criminal enforcement of tax evasion today. So, of course, it would follow that there's an enormous amount of tax avoidance, legal kind of maneuvers to get around taxes that might be aggressive and abusive, and evasion, which is illegal tax evasion. There was just one recent case of a money manager, but other than that, there have been very few high-profile tax evasion cases in recent years.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Senator Pat Toomey is quoted actually in the New York Times today, an article about your story. My intention as the author of the 2016 tax reform was not that multimillionaires ought to pay no taxes. I believe dividends and capital gains should be taxed at a lower rate, but certainly not zero. And I'm curious about the response that you've gotten to some of these people that you have named in this article, like Jeff Bezos.
That was a remarkable statement from Senator Toomey, and if he has had a kind of change of heart from being a big supporter of the giant Trump tax cuts that disproportionately went to the wealthy just a few years ago, that would be pretty interesting. We reached out to everyone mentioned in the article, and were willing to give detailed questions to almost all of them, and we did present detailed questions on the findings. That was part of the verification. Is ultimately we had verified the information in myriad ways, but then we went to every subject of the story, and that's just good journalism. You go to the subject of the story, and you give them the information that you're going to write about, and you have them respond. And And Buffett and Bloomberg and Soros and Icahn responded to us, Carl Icahn, the corporate investor. Bezos did not respond at all. In fact, representatives of Bezos didn't want to receive questions about it, which was one of the most sort of bizarre responses I've ever had from any plutocratic entity or corporate entity that I've ever responded to or, you know, tried to report on. So that was this unusual situation. And we have yet to hear from Bezos. But of course, we do welcome their comments. And we you can comment subsequently. But we didn't hear from Mackenzie Scott or Jeff Bezos.
And Jesse, we're almost out of time here. Interestingly, Warren Buffett is an interesting billionaire, I guess I can put it that way, because he does say, and I believe told you, that he's going to give away all his money, and that will be his gift to America.
Yeah, many of these guys do offer giant philanthropic gifts, and they consider that to be a form of giving back to society. And it is a form of giving back to society, but is not taxes. What Buffett said to us was he prefers giving philanthropy than to pay down the debt with his taxes. And to which I say, you know, I wish I could allocate my tax dollars the way I want for my own personal priorities and have my name attached to those dollars too. But I can't. I'm part of a democracy and I'm in the tax system, and I must give my tax dollars and elect officials that allocate the money the way the society wants. So they're outside of societal rules, and they can allocate their money the way they want for their own personal priorities and sometimes their own glorification and certainly their obsessions and hobby horses, and dominate our policy discourse. And we are not. We are just beholden to our system.
Well, Jesse Eisinger, thank you for joining us once again on Radio Times. We look forward to this continuing series looking at our tax system and the uber wealthy.
Great. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. That's Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter, editor at ProPublica, one of the authors of this report that got released, published this week, The Secret IRS Files, Trove of Never-Before-Seen Records Reveal How the Wealthiest Avoid Income Tax. Well, we'll be talking about the rest of us after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were just talking about how the wealthiest people in the country are able to legally pay little or no federal income taxes, an expose by ProPublica. Now we want to talk about the real economy, the racial wealth gap, and the uneven recovery from the pandemic when millions lost their jobs, many of them Black and Latino workers making low wages. Stimulus checks from the federal government actually improved their quality of life, allowing them to pay bills and buy food, even reduce their anxiety and depression. Last month, the country added 559,000 jobs to the U.S. economy. Joining us is Valerie Wilson. She's an economist at the Economic Policy Institute, director of the EPI's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. And Valerie Wilson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
This morning.
It's nice to have you with us. And let me just make sure we can get your volume up. We got your volume up. I don't know whether you've had a chance to read this ProPublica story this week about the 25 richest Americans paying little or no federal income taxes because of our tax code. It's all very legal. But if you have, I'd just be curious about your response.
I have not had an opportunity to read the report. But what I will say about that is that, you know, we know that wealth affords any number of mobility-enhancing opportunities, that be it the ability to own property, start a business, pay for higher education, or build a secure retirement. Also, especially coming out of the pandemic, it provides a degree of economic stability against uncertainties like job loss or illness. So it's really important that we have a tax system that gets the excessively wealthy to contribute more to the society from which they've greatly benefited, because that helps to provide the kinds of resources that can be used to expand access and improve the quality of these wealth-enhancing opportunities for more Americans.
Well, and I wonder, and this is sort of speaking rather broadly, but sort of jumping off, you know, these are the uber wealthy, so it's not you and me and our listeners here. But do we make it hard for especially moderate income people in this country or low income people in this country to accumulate wealth, to create wealth, which is something that can be, you know, handed down to that next generation?
It is difficult, mainly because the majority of people in this country receive their income through labor, through working. And so their ability to sustain and care for their families is directly attached to their ability to grow their income or wealth otherwise. And specifically, when we talk about the racial wealth gap, related to that, there's also an employment, racial employment disparity, as well as a racial wage gap. So there are already uneven opportunities in terms of people's ability to gain income through work, much less accumulate savings or make investments that will allow them to build wealth.
Has this pandemic revealed some of the realities of these various gaps that you just mentioned?
I think the pandemic has put a spotlight on many of these inequalities in a way that I think has really captured everyone's attention. The pandemic and the recession essentially split the workforce into three groups. There were, you know, the tens of millions who lost their jobs when everything had to go on pause and shut down. But then there were a group of workers who were able to continue working as, you know, essential workers, as they were labeled, but then had some degree of health risk associated with that because they had to continue to go to work in person. The third group of folks were those who could, you know, generally work safely from home, so they maintained their economic security at the same time that they were able to protect their health. Low-wage workers and workers of color were least likely to be in that third group, had greater economic and health security, and therefore were more vulnerable both in terms of the health risk, but also in terms of the economic risks. On top of that, those were the same workers that went into the recession and the pandemic with less to begin with.
Well, and I wonder, too, from them, you know, I'm losing track of our recessions, but the recession of 2008, 2009, and I'm assuming that affected, affected a lot of people, but affected people of color in pretty dramatic kinds of ways.
Yes, any recession affects people of color in very dramatic ways because of these longstanding structural and systemic inequities across any number of economic outcomes. I think what has made the current recession different is that it was generated because of the pandemic. So there was a hard stop on the economy.
Absolutely. Yeah, a screeching halt, really.
Yeah, yeah. And so the unique thing starting out was that, you know, it was a pretty even effect at the beginning because everything stopped. But as the recovery has progressed, we have started to see some of these gaps and disparities re-emerging, mainly because the most heavily industries are also the industries that employ a disproportionate number of low-wage workers, as well as women of color in particular.
Right. And we're having a little audio. We're going to hang in there. I think I'm looking at our engineer here. But what you were saying, Valerie Wilson, is that these low wage workers, these were in what, hospitality, retail, I mean, this grocery stores. I mean, this is kind of face to face kind of interactions during the pandemic. Do I have that right?
Yes, the greatest losses were in leisure and hospitality, in government, as well as in education and health, but largely on the education side of that.
Now, last month, we added something like 559,000 jobs to the economy. That's those are good numbers, I think, by almost any measure. But what if we dig deep, and if we're talking about people who've been really hit hard by the pandemic, lost their job, or are, you know, working in low-wage jobs, are they helped by these numbers?
So the growth in May is a good sign. It's a positive sign. It's definitely a step in the right direction. But yes, absolutely. There is still a long way to go. You know, even though leisure and hospitality has consistently been the industry that has added the most jobs, in particular over the last 3 months, it was also the industry that lost the most jobs. And it remains about 2.5 million jobs short of where it was in February 2020.
And we know about restaurants as well, right? They're something like 1 million people short.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Restaurants will fall into that umbrella of leisure and hospitality. Yeah.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Valerie Wilson. She's an economist at the Economic Policy Institute, also director of the EPI's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. And we asked her to join us on Radio Times. We began by talking about the uber wealthy in this country. We want to make sure that we focus on the people who have been hit hardest by this pandemic, who work in low-wage jobs. These are often Black employees, often Latino workers as well. And we want to hear from you. You send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Valerie, I was reading a number of articles, and they were talking about that workers have leverage now. They have clout, that employers are, you know, looking to hire, and we're going to see increased wage growth. We're going to see, you know, incentives to get people to work. Are you seeing that? And are these incentives, are these targeted to people who really were hit hardest by the pandemic?
Well, I think some of the, well, one of the industries where we have seen some marked wage growth over the last several months has been leisure and hospitality, restaurants in particular. Part of that, I think, is related to the fact that as more of the country reopens, more in-person dining establishments are opening up to full capacity, then there will be the demand for more workers in those industries. And so, you know, reasonably, in order to attract people back to the labor market and to compensate folks for the fact that they're still taking on some degree of risk by being in those jobs, it's totally reasonable that wages would be rising in that industry. But part of that increase as well, again, a lot of the growth has been in-person restaurants and bars. So a lot of that growth is related to the return of more people who would tip workers. The way that those wages are reported by BLS includes tips as well as their base pay.
I wondered, too, if we could focus just a bit on Black women, on Latinas. I know they were, in many ways, from what I read, hardest hit by the pandemic. Again, working in these jobs that we've been talking about, which tend to be, you know, low wage. Maybe they don't have even health benefits, things like that. What can be done to help this group of workers?
Well, I think one of the things that has helped this group of workers has been the expanded unemployment insurance benefits. The fact that these workers were eligible to receive at one point an additional $600 and now an additional $300 was really important to help them to continue to provide for themselves and their families, as well as the relief checks that were sent to families. So both of those things have been important to these workers. But a continued challenge for women in particular is related to schools still not being fully reopened. And we hope and expect that by the fall, as more schools are open, that we will start to see more opportunities for women who desire to return to the workforce to be able to do so then.
And these stimulus checks and some of these unemployment benefits did keep families afloat, but I think it also raised questions about low-wage work when you get essentially more money not being employed than you do at your low-wage job. What does that tell us about the economy?
Yeah, that is an important point to make, that the fact that you could, you know, receive more in benefits. And again, we have to note that these benefits were increased intentionally to address the nature of the crisis that we were in. But even if that's the case, you know, it definitely shines a light on just how low wages and earnings are in that industry. For example, if we consider what the typical worker in, say, the restaurant, bars, hotels, and recreation sector earns on an annual basis, that's about $20,714.
Wow. Is that full-time work, or that's some version of full-time work?
So that's converting the current weekly wage into an annual earning.
Got it. So it might not be full-time, but it's what someone is spending their time during the week working.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that's another important point about the pandemic. And in addition to people losing jobs entirely, you know, there were also workers who saw their hours cut. Another challenge in that industry is having consistent hours, consistently scheduled, but also consistently receiving enough hours per week to be able to earn enough to support your family.
And again, that's Valerie Wilson from the Economic Policy Institute, our guest today on Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm curious, Valerie, what you think about an expanded child tax credit, universal pre-K. These are all ideas that are being floated from the Biden administration to try to, you know, shore up and help some of these families that live closer to the edge. How much do you think this could help them?
I think those kinds of investments are huge. I think those are things that needed to happen anyway. And I take it as a positive sign that we're making the most of the situation that we're in and using this as an opportunity to make those kinds of investments for the long term, because they really will have important payoffs, not just to the current workforce, but also in terms of our future workforce. Universal pre-K investments in early childhood education is really an investment in the workforce of the future as well.
Do you feel optimistic as you look into your crystal ball when it relates to the economy, and especially the economy for more low-income workers?
So I think the Biden administration has taken some important steps to keep the recovery moving, to try to fill some of those gaps and holes that were putting low-wage workers in a particularly precarious and vulnerable position. So I'm hopeful that the recovery will be better, hopefully, yeah, in terms of the pace than coming out of 2008. But, you know, there still remains a lot to be done and a lot to continue to keep our eyes on as the recovery continues to build.
We're almost out of time here, but you mentioned 2008. And one of the criticisms from the Obama administration was they didn't invest enough money, you know, to help the recession. Now there's complaints that Biden's investing too much money. But how do you see that?
So, yeah, you can never make everyone happy, right?
That's for sure.
So I would agree with the idea that there was not enough done under the Obama administration, which is why the recovery was so slow. It took so long to, you know, really get us back to full speed. I think the Biden administration has taken some very bold steps in terms of, you know, the size of the investments that have been made and the kinds of investments that have been made. And, you know, we're still at a shortfall relative to February 2020, but, you know, the economy continues to add jobs at a solid pace.
Well, we have to leave it there. Valerie Wilson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Nice to have you with us. And she's an economist at the Economic Policy Institute, director of the EPI's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, which you can do wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Kelsey Hansen, and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.